John McCulloch has helped shape the writing and careers of David Foster Wallace, Ann Patchett, and Jeffrey Eugenides, among others, as managing editor of the Paris Review and then Tin House. But now it's her own name on the cover of a book, a memoir called All Happy Families, just out from Harper Wave. In it, she takes a deep, intimate look into her own family and other family members' lives, starting with one particular day in August 1983 in the Hamptons. It's both wonderfully wry and moving, and I'm very happy that Jean McCulloch joins us here today. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for being
it's
here.
It's great to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. We're just in the afternoon.
Good midday.
There you go. That's very appropriate. In your acknowledgments, you mentioned that both your editor and agent were more than extremely patient with you,
yes,
and that you eventually ran out of excuses. What made the writing of this so difficult for you, to have the tables turned and be writing yourself? I mean, you're an editor by trade, and now you're actually doing the writing. Was that particularly painful and maybe unexpectedly difficult for you?
Exactly. It was unexpectedly difficult, but I probably should have expected it. There's a few qualities that an editor has naturally that are very useful when you're writing your own book, finally. And one of them is you're used to listening. You listen to your authors. You listen to their rhythms and cadences on the page. And you look for their arc, their narrative arc, as they're telling their story. And this can be both helpful and daunting when you sit down to do your own work, because you kind of know the process. And yet what you're really doing is wading through your own storage box of memories and stories and traumas and pains and delights to tell your own tale.
Mm-hmm.
And so you both have the facility and you know how darn hard it is. I came to feel that the secret for me of writing a memoir, because I had been offered a contract based on an essay that I had written. And to be honest, I wasn't quite sure where the story was going to go from there.
It was a personal essay that was published.
It was a personal essay that had been published in an anthology called Money Changes Everything. And it was 22 different writers writing about, you know, the joys and the pitfalls of money in all guises, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I had written about growing up in this rather unique house in this time in the 60s and 70s in East Hampton. And basically what I was trying to tackle was the fact that privilege, or what looks like privilege on the outside, i.e. a big house on the beach, can have in it just as much family dysfunction as exists anywhere else. And in my case, there was also the element of addiction, another universal theme. My father was an alcoholic. Now, in that essay, because it was only 5,000 words,
mm-hmm,
I didn't have to get into the alcoholism. And I think that was what I was trying to avoid.
Mm.
So when I sat down to write the memoir, I realized, no, I'm going to have to tell this story.
Was that the hardest part of it, to delve into your father's alcoholism?
Yes, it was, because what I had to do, which ended up being very useful, is really look at how that affected me as a child.
Mm.
As the child of an alcoholic, you tend to go into the background a bit because there's a drama going on around you, right?
Mm.
I don't know if that's universally true, but that was my experience at any rate. So in wanting to tell this story, I had to really examine that and come to terms with how that had affected me. I chose to open the memoir on the morning of my wedding day, exactly 35 years ago today,
yes,
as it happens.
Today or, wow.
Well, it was yesterday, yeah.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you. And my father, 2 days before that, had been taken in an ambulance to the hospital because he was suffering from abrupt alcohol withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
So he was hooked up to machines. My fiance and I found that out as we were driving out to our wedding. with my wedding dress in the back seat. And we called the housekeeper to say we were running late. And she said, go straight to Southampton Hospital. And from there, we heard that his stroke had been massive. And yet my mother was absolutely convinced we needed to go ahead with the wedding. And as I said, I'd sort of lost my voice. And I decided, okay, we're going to do this. Almost robotically, we're going to do this. And in writing the memoir, the one image that kept coming back to me was me in my wedding dress. I got married at home, and I was in the bathroom of my mother's room. And I could hear the music, the string quartet playing below, and people being seated. And I was just staring at myself in this veil in the mirror, brushing my hair. And I heard her call the hospital and say to the doctor, if anything happens to my husband tonight, do not call this house. We're having a party.
Wow.
That was the image that had stuck with me all of these years that I was in my storage box in my head. And it took me years and years to want to approach that and to sort of feel like I had the tools in life to approach it.
Yeah. Was it a story that you had not shared before with others? That particular moment being in the bathroom and hearing your mother on the phone and as your father's in the hospital?
Not really. Other people in my family and a few other people obviously knew that was her goal.
Sure.
Was because she was, I think, you know, in her defense, she felt like his drinking had sidetracked so many family events that she was determined that we should go ahead and do this.
Right.
But as a consequence, we had two families coming together for one event that became a very different event.
Right.
So I think one of the reasons it took me a long time to write this is because, to my mind, memoir is not a place where you work out your stuff in a place of public entertainment. You work your stuff out to the extent you can and you process it, and then you tell the story.
Right.
So now it's 35 years later, and I'm sitting here telling you the story.
Sure. And that was it clear to you when you sat down to write that this was where you would begin with that moment?
Yes. I actually tried to put that a little bit further along, and it just didn't feel right to me. I felt like I had to go back and put it right at the beginning. And also to have what she said to the doctor right at the beginning, because to me, that was the launching pad for this.
I'm Matt Katz. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I've been speaking with Jean McCulloch about her memoir, All Happy Families. Your parents in this memoir come across as being almost larger than life. Can you give us a little sketch of who they were?
Yes. My mother was larger than life in many ways. She had an aspect to her that was quite imperious, but also quite endearing. My friends adored her. When we were in our teens, everybody used to come over and smoke cigarettes with my mother and drink diet ginger ale and gossip. But she also had a sort of a steely reserve about her. And deep inside, she had her own vulnerabilities. There was an inner child in her that felt quite abandoned by her own mother, who had died early. And that inner child sometimes came out, and we would just want to push that inner child back in because the inner child was very, very needy. So she was an interesting combination of a certain kind of insecurity and yet this larger-than-life, imperious, generous but imperious woman.
Yeah.
And juxtaposed against that was my father, who was very loving. He spoke 14 languages. He was a brilliant scholar, but he was also an older father by the time my sisters and I came along. He was well into his 50s, which in those days was an old guy. Now that's quite common. But he had this drinking problem, and that was really his Achilles heel. So he would take us on these wonderful trips, because every year he would learn a language sitting in his pajamas in our living room. He would learn a new language and put all of these verb forms on index cards all over my mother's rug next to his slippers. And then in the summer, he would want to go to wherever he could speak it. So we would end up going off, so, you know, to Kenya so he could speak Swahili to a Maasai tribesman.
Wow.
Or we would be playing hide and seek around the Parthenon so that he could teach us how to count to 10 in Greek. So these were the great adventures. But as I describe in the book, the flip side of that was often then he would disappear behind his eyes, and you mm-hmm. knew that he'd been drinking heavily, and you knew that he was gone to us, even though he was there. Hmm. He was no longer in the room.
Wow. You said that he seemed to have a mysterious background, too. You weren't exactly sure.
Yes, well, his his background, he was born in 1908, my father, so he was sort of a relic that sort of arced over the entire 20th century. Hmm. He had gone to Yale when he was 16. He had been in the OSS, and because he had such a facility with languages, he was kept after World War II ended, and he sort of became this kind of, I say, he became like a traffic cop there, because he had German soldiers coming one way and Italians coming the other way and the Americans and the British coming. Everybody was trying to, you know, figure out where they all were and what fit in. And this is, of course, well before we were born. He had four children from his first marriage mm-hmm. at that point. By the time we were born, he was settled in New York as a single man. He'd been divorced from his first wife, and that's when he met my mother. So a lot of it for us became myth, that part of his life.
But you remember some... many things about him, but particularly some of the things he told you. I loved how he told you the three key things to show your proficiency in a language. Can you tell us what those three things are?
Yeah, well, because he spoke so many languages, and we spoke to him lamentably few. We spoke French, and I was struggling through Spanish only because he told me I could drop math if I took up another language. Those were the values in my family. But he said, if you could understand song lyrics in a different language, mm-hmm. that was a huge accomplishment, because it meant you were hearing the rhythms of that language. But very importantly, if you started dreaming in that language, you really were getting some sort of proficiency in it. And I remember when I spent a year at the Sorbonne in France, in Paris, when I was in college. And I remember he would always say to me, are you dreaming in French yet? Are you dreaming in French yet?
Did you ever dream in French?
A little bit, but I can't tell whether I did it of my own volition,
sure.
or whether I just felt like, hey, Dad, I just said something right. in French in my dreams.
I want to turn back to your mother for a moment. You write that your mother had a, quote, hole in her soul. Where do you imagine that came from?
Well, that was what I was alluding to before when mm-hmm. I said she had her inner child was a very young girl who felt abandoned.
Ah.
And I think she carried that abandonment complex
from her mother, yeah.
All through her life. Again, this was myth to us, but it came out a lot when this little needy inner child in her came popping out. And, mm-hmm. you know, she could have been... dressed up regally to go off and do something very public, but then this needy little child would come out of her and just things she would say. So that hole seems to be that she felt that she'd missed out in her life somehow, that the kind of love that she should have had was absent when she was growing up. Hmm. And it's always odd when you're a child to have a parent, particularly a mother, if you're female, speak like that to you, because you're supposed to be the child, and suddenly here is somebody who feels very vulnerable in a way that's not exactly, doesn't make you confident, doesn't make you feel secure. Mm. You feel like maybe there's something you should be doing, but you don't have the facility to do anything because you're a child.
Right, right. In exploring all of this and writing about all these people and writing about your husband and your parents and his family,
yes.
How did your views of them change in the course of writing this?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because since the subject is so old, since I was writing it over 30 years after the events, I had, and many of them were gone off the planet. They weren't alive anymore. It was almost as if I had to conduct a literary seance in my head to try to get their voices back and to really remember.
A literary seance.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And some of it I had written down. A lot from my husband's family in Maine I had actually written down at the time.
Oh, okay.
Because at the time I was a managing editor at the Paris Review, and I thought someday I'll write my own stories. I was writing all
Turns
these things
right.
down.
Yeah.
But I couldn't hear a lot because it had been so long. And there was one particular line of my mother's that I ended up only hearing really in the final draft. And I was walking my dogs one day in Brooklyn where I live. And I heard her say, "I wish I could have been a better mother to you that weekend of your wedding, but I was numb." And I hadn't heard that before, but that is certainly what she said. And I suddenly thought, that's the missing piece. That's what I'm missing.
Wow.
That's where she became human at that point.
And when did she say that to you?
She said it, there's, as you will recall, in the third section of the book, she and I are in the attic 5 years after my wedding. I've already been divorced, and obviously my father had passed away. All my wedding presents were up there. My wedding presents that I never opened, because the day after the wedding, my mother asked me to stash them up there to get the clutter out of the front hall, mm-hmm. because she was planning a funeral. So they had never been opened. She and I went up there because we had to, at that point, divide them up because my husband was taking his and I was taking mine. And as we're up there opening these things, that's when she said it to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jean, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it.
Well, it's been a joy to speak to you. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Jean McCulloch about her memoir, All Happy Families. Tonight at 7:30 p.m., she will be in conversation with Meg Wolitzer at Books Are Magic. That's at 225 Smith Street in Brooklyn.